Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally on KU Band Radio at Telstar 5, 7 days a week, here on Truth Radio Network, and in more than 70 countries worldwide on the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit my webpage. That's georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Remember, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on personal identification. All right, last time we were talking about this thing of personal identification in the light of the new decision by the Supreme Court called Heibel, H-I-I-B-E-L, versus the 6th Judicial District Court of Nevada, Humboldt County, et al. You can find a copy of the case. It's Find Law on the Internet, Find Law. The case number is 03-5554. That's number 03-5554. Now, last time, it brought us up to the other, that is, the second case, that's what we call a landmark case or a base case, called Lawson versus Colander. I told you the story about how Lawson went out on the sidewalk with his television set and walked up and down in front of his house when the cop came. He stepped back on his lawn, and the process for the government from that point on was all downhill. These are called test cases. You can bet that when Rosa Parks got on the bus down in Montgomery, Alabama, in the trade, we call her the goat. She's the one who's going to go out and test this law. Now, I don't know if Heibel was a goat testing this law. I kind of doubt it. There wasn't any need to test it because we've already got two cases, Lawson versus Colander, that we're going to review and analyze tonight. And Brown versus Texas, the Texas case on Fourth Amendment intrusions that we investigated last time here on the Law Hour. Sandra Day O'Connor, the other female, now remember she's the first female to serve on the Supreme Court. She's from Arizona, a Westerner, pretty level-headed, common-sense conservative on the court, appointed by Reagan. And then we get another woman on the court who took the opposite view in this Heibel case. Her name is Ginsburg. She's a flaming liberal from the other side. I mentioned to you that the liberals on the court rule more consistently with the principles of individual rights than do the conservatives. So in judicial matters, I prefer liberals on the court. And in conservative political circles, I prefer to have conservatives in control of the Congress and the White House, although our current president is no conservative. Or if there's anything conservative about George Bush, it is so well hidden, I haven't been able to find it yet. And if you take a look at the House and Senate, except for Ron Paul, I can't find any other conservatives in that body. If there are any, let me know, would you? Send me a letter and tell me who the other conservative representative is in our House of Representatives. And if you can identify a conservative in the Senate, he's so well hidden I haven't been able to find him. Let me know if there is one, would you? Well, Sandra Day O'Connor is oftentimes called the swing vote. Now, when this case came down in 85, she'd just been appointed, so she was a new kid on the block. The case is decided well. It's well-reasoned. I think it's very logical. Brown versus Texas, I think, was very well-reasoned and very logical. Even this case, Heibel versus 6th Judicial District, I don't agree with the outcome, but the case was well-reasoned. It's very logical. And we're going to have to get used to this new test, this new standard. But let's compare what we've already heard about Heibel and Brown with what the court tells us now in Lawson versus Colander. Let's see if I've got a citation here on Lawson v. Colander. Decided 1983. Am I right there? Yeah. decided May 2nd, 1983. My case is so old here it came out of United States Law Week. It's got a number attached to it. It's number 81-1320. All you'll have to do is go to Find Law, plug in Lawson. It's actually called William Colander et al. Petitioner versus Edward Lawson. So Colander is spelled K-O-L-E-N-D-E-R versus Lawson, L-A-W-S-O-N. Lawson is the black guy. Colander is the chief of police. The number, the reference number that I've got here, which came out of Law Week, is 81-1320. I'm not sure that's going to do you any good. But if you looked it up in Law Week, United States Law Week, 51LW4532, dated 5383, you'd also come up with William Colander. Here's what Justice O'Connor delivered for the majority of the court. And let's see, White filed a dissenting opinion in which Rehnquist joined. So this case came down 7-2 in favor of Lawson, the black guy carrying his TV set on the front walk. And the other case, Brown v. Texas. Let me back up and see how that one came down. See if I can find it here. Lawson, come on, Brown. Brown v. Texas. I got this out of the U.S. Supreme Court reports, and I don't have anything in here that tells me how the case came out, whether it was 5-4, 6-3, 7-2, or 9-0. But in the Lawson versus Colander case, it's 7-2. Now, this appeal presents a facial challenge to a criminal statute that requires persons who loiter or wander on the streets to provide a credible and reliable identification and to account for their presence when requested by a peace officer under circumstances that would justify a stop under the standards of Terry versus Ohio. We conclude that the statute, as it has been construed, is unconstitutionally vague within the meaning of the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment. By failing to clarify what is contemplated by the requirement that a suspect provide a credible and reliable identification, accordingly, we affirm the judgment of the court below. Now, the appealee, Edward Lawson, was detained or arrested on approximately 15 occasions between March of 1975 and January of 1977, pursuant to California Penal Code 647E. Lawson was prosecuted only twice and was convicted once. Now, Lawson is out here testing this personal identification statute 15 times. He's arrested twice, convicted once. The second charge was dismissed. Now, Lawson then brought a civil action in the District Court for the Southern District of California seeking a declaratory judgment that 647E is unconstitutional, a mandatory in seeking a declaratory judgment, a mandatory injunction seeking a restraining order, to restrain enforcement of the statute, and compensatory and punitive damages against the various officers who detained him. Now, he collected on that. It was $130,000. I would say, based upon what we've seen here so far, that Lawson is a pro se litigant, and he is out on the street bear baiting the cops on a test case. Now, the district court found that 647E was overbroad because a person who is stopped on less than probable cause cannot be punished for failing to identify himself. The district court enjoined enforcement of the statute, but held that Lawson could not recover damages because the officers involved acted in good faith belief that each detention or arrest was lawful. It's called the subjective good faith defense. If you want to sue a police officer, you have to have a specialty book, such as police misconduct, in order to overcome the affirmative defenses that the police are going to advance. It's called a specialty book. Now, the appellant, H.A. Perazzo, he's the Deputy Chief Commander of the California Highway Patrol, appealed the district court decision to the Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit. Lawson cross-appealed, arguing that he was entitled to a jury trial on the issue of damages against the officers. The Court of Appeals affirmed the district court determination as to the unconstitutionality of 647E. The appellate court determined that the statute was unconstitutional in that it violates the Fourth Amendment's prescription against unreasonable searches and seizures. It contains a vague enforcement standard that is susceptible to arbitrary enforcement, and it fails to give fair and adequate notice of the type of conduct prohibited. Finally, the Court of Appeals reversed the district court as to its holding that Lawson was not entitled to a jury trial to determine the good faith of the officers in his damages action against them, and it remanded the case to the district court for trial. The officers appealed to this court from that portion of the judgment of the Court of Appeals which declared 647E unconstitutional and which enjoined its enforcement. We noted probable jurisdiction pursuant to 28 U.S.C. 1254-2. And in the courts below, Lawson mounted an attack on the facial validity of 647E. In evaluating a facial challenge to a state law, a federal court must, of course, consider any limiting construction that a state court or enforcement agency has preferred. As construed by the California Court of Appeals, 647E requires that an individual provide credible and reliable identification when requested by a police officer who has reasonable suspicion of criminal activity sufficient to justify a Terry detention. Credible and reliable identification is defined by the State Court of Appeals as identification carrying reasonable assurance that the identification is authentic and providing means for later getting in touch with the person who has identified himself. In addition, a suspect may be required to account for his presence, at least to the extent that it assists in producing credible and reliable identification. Under the terms of the statute, failure of the individual to provide credible and reliable identification permits the arrest. All right, now let's understand something here. The courts are not in the business of turning criminals free, and they're not in the business of giving license to the police to just use carte blanche to arrest us at will. Now, the trick for each and every one of us is to obey all the laws of the United States, all the laws of your state, and all the laws of God, and do all three simultaneously. It's tough, but it's not impossible. And in so doing, you will have all of your constitutional rights, all of your constitutional protections, and the benefits of Exodus 23:20-24 available to you at all times 24/7. That's what I teach. That's what I recommend. Now, when we find that there is a contradiction between the law of God and the law of the United States, or a contradiction between the law of the United States and the law of a state, then you and I have a duty. We have a duty to challenge that law and correct it. And that's what Lawson is doing here. That's what Rosa Parks did by riding the front of the bus. That's what the civil rights issues of the 1960s and 70s were all about. It was about people just like you and me who were dissatisfied with the policies that were being inflicted upon them by the political forces of their states. The state legislature of Alabama, the city council of Montgomery, Alabama, or in this case, the city council or the state legislature of California. And so Lawson and Rosa Parks and others that are known as civil rights activists. I'm one of those. George Gordon is a civil rights activist. I actively go about seeking these unconstitutional laws or policies that conflict with either the law of God or the law of the state or the law of the United States for the purposes of making meaningful political and social change in the local community. That's why I operate a law school and I teach civil rights. All right, you're listening to the Law Hour and the Editorial Review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, did you know that many of the lessons that you're listening to or hearing on the Law Hour are just a small part of my 2-week school on courtroom strategy and procedure? This class includes lessons ranging from what to do and what not to do at the arrest or when you receive a complaint, a summons, or a citation. And you'll learn how to make a chronology of the names, dates, times, places, facts, witnesses, and evidence, just like the police do, which is called proof. And you'll learn how to conduct a hearing, present evidence, cross-examine witnesses, ask questions, make opening and closing statements, enter exhibits into evidence, write motions, write briefs, write affidavits and asseverations. And I don't cover just what goes on in the courtroom either. You'll learn the preliminary procedures, such as arraignments and bail setting and what papers to file, how to put exculpatory evidence into the record, how to present your legal and lawful positions, what issues are appealable, how do you preserve those appealable issues for appellate review like we see going on here to the United States Supreme Court or to the state Supreme Court of your state. Well, there are 28 essential elements that you have to master in courtroom strategy and procedure. If you want to be good at litigation, there's just 28 things you need to know. Not 2,800 or 280, just 28 things that'll make you a good, competent pro se litigant. And you'll learn all of them here at the law school in this class. Now, if you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, just call me at 417-273-4967 and be sure to ask for my free General Law CD package while you're at it. Now, that's a four-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative. It's free of charge. And courtroom strategy and procedure is available on compact disc for adult home education. If you're online, go to the website. It's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Click onto that email. Send me an email request for your free General Law CD package. Do it right now before you forget. Or if you prefer, call direct. Area code 417-273-4967. All right, we're looking at Lawson versus Colander. Now, this guy, Lawson, took his TV, went out on the sidewalk, walked up and down, got himself arrested. He'd been arrested 15 times for failing to identify himself. One was dismissed. One was prosecuted and convicted. That's the one he was looking for. This was a sting. This was a setup. Lawson was the goat. Lawson wanted to make a meaningful political and social change in California over this law that he thought was unconstitutional. He was right. It was unconstitutional. Now, a word of caution. When you challenge a law facially, like Lawson did in this case, about 10% of the time you'll win and 90% of the time you'll lose because of Ashwander versus Tennessee Valley Authority. The safer course of action is to get off of the unconstitutionality of the statute itself, per se, and concentrate on the operation of the statute being unconstitutional as it's being applied to you in this case, which is what we saw in Brown v. Texas. Now, Heibel didn't make any of the correct arguments. He didn't argue the Fourth Amendment. He didn't argue the Fifth Amendment. He didn't argue the vagueness. He was represented by the Public Defender's Office of Carson City. I said I'd give the Carson City Public Defender's Office their due. They were probably just incompetent. Just didn't know what they were doing. I won't say that they were acting maliciously, as I described in Morton Grove. That guy was malicious. That was a setup. That was a reverse sting operation by a mole pretending to be a Second Amendment advocate when in reality he is a Second Amendment foe, an enemy, a fifth columnist. Now, I said that if you would write me a letter and send me a $5 bill, I would copy the 12 questions that I've developed to qualify personal identification at the scene of the crime for both Fourth and Fifth Amendment review. Now, the reason that I'm not going to give that information to you over the air on this program is because that's giving legal advice. And the lawyers of America have a monopoly on legal advice, just like the doctors have a medical monopoly on medical advice. I can't give you medical advice, but if you send me a letter and ask me, what do you think, Mr. Gordon, about AIDS, herpes, and VD, I can tell you what I think. And that's because I've got a right to free speech, but I can't come over the air and tell you, here's what this law means, or here's Here's the legal advice that you're looking for. Here's the answer that you're looking for. So let's obey all the laws of the United States and all the laws of the state of Missouri and all the laws of God, and let's do it all at the same time. So you just drop a $5 bill into an envelope. Now, if you want to know what I'm going to give you, I'm going to give you these 12 questions and answers, and I'm going to give you the article on, are the police liable? Do they have any requirement, any law, any duty to protect you, the citizen? I'm going to tell you the answer. They don't. And I'm going to give you the cases and tell you why. It's a two-page article. And I've got to have a couple of bucks here to pay you or pay for the postage that I'm going to send to you, this little package, little envelope. And I got to pay somebody to go photocopy it and make this up and put it in an envelope and send it to you. And I think $5 is well worth the information. If you want it, why, send for it. And if you don't, well, forget it. Let it lay. Now, we're talking about the second landmark case called Lawson versus Colander. And here's our Supreme Court Justice, Sandra Day O'Connor, going on. She says, our Constitution is designed to maximize individual freedoms within a framework of orderly liberty. Hey, that's a lady after my own heart. Let me read that again. You know, judges are on our side. Judges were designed to work for individuals, not majorities, not political expedience. When you've got a problem, like this guy Lawson, arrested 15 times, says, I got a problem here with this law. I want a remedy for it. 9 members of the Supreme Court sit down and give this one man in California, one black man in California who knows how to walk, talk, and chew gum and walk into court and get a remedy. That's the difference. No discrimination involved. This guy doesn't need any affirmative action. He just needs 9 square feet to plant his feet in the middle of the courtroom floor and to present his case. And if he knows how to do it, he can get a remedy. And here's our justice of the Supreme Court says, our Constitution is designed to maximize, not minimize, to maximize individual freedom within a framework of orderly liberty. And so when we talk about Heibel is standing here. We got a policeman. The policeman has a job. He's been called out here. Come on, guys, let's be intelligent. I mean, after all, the police have a job to do, and we have a duty to at least get out of their way. Now, if the policeman oversteps his authority, which is what we're talking about here in Lawson, if the legislature oversteps its capacity and its authority, then we need some individual. We don't need a majority. We don't need tens of thousands. We don't need petitions. We just need one good man to come into court and change this. And that's what Lawson did. That's what Brown did. Just one good man, just one good, competent pro se litigant to walk in here, stake out his 9 square feet on the courtroom floor and say, okay, boys and girls, listen up. Let me tell you how this is coming down. In order to maximize our liberty. Now, statutory limitations on these freedoms are examined for substantive authority and content as well as for definiteness. God, I can't pronounce that word. I want to make it more definite, or certainty of expression. See, generally, substantive criminal law. As generally stated, the void for vagueness doctrine requires that a penal statute define the criminal offense with sufficient definiteness. Let me try that again. With sufficient definiteness that ordinary people can understand what conduct is prohibited and in a manner that does not encourage arbitrary and discriminatory enforcement. So what the court is trying to balance here is your right under the Fourth and Fifth Amendment against the arbitrary and capricious enforcement of the law. Now that's what all of us are complaining about. We're complaining about the policeman who comes out here and under color of law uses his authority under the law to harass you. And the courts have a word for that. It's called the arbitrary and capricious enforcement of the law. That's what it is that you're arguing against. That's what Brown was arguing against. He was arguing against the arbitrary enforcement of a statute. The cop comes in and says, well, you're going to tell me who you are, and if you don't tell me who you are, I'm going to arrest you and take you to jail. Now, that's so common nationwide, and that's our biggest complaint, those of us that are civil rights activists. We're here to keep the police in line. It's my contention, and I told Chief Montgomery this up in Boise, Idaho years ago. I said, Chief, you and your 168 Boise police officers are going to have to obey the law just like all the rest of us. Now, the difference is those policemen are out here enforcing the laws, whether they're constitutional or unconstitutional, upon all of us, basically because of our ignorance. And then they do it in an arbitrary and capricious way and make obnoxious jerks of themselves, for which they need to be knocked down a peg. Now, that's what the bottom line is, and that's what the civil rights movement was all about. It was to knock down these arrogant cops two or three pegs and get them to obey the laws just like all the rest of us do. That's the bottom line. Now, although the doctrine focuses both on actual notice to citizens and arbitrary enforcement, we have recognized recently that the more important aspect of the vagueness doctrine is not actual notice, but the other principal element of the doctrine, the requirement that a legislature establish minimal guidelines to govern law enforcement officers. Now, where the legislature fails to provide such minimal guidelines, then a criminal statute may permit a standardless sweep that allows policemen, prosecutors, and juries to pursue their personal predilections and prejudices. And Section 647E, as presently drafted and construed by the state courts, contains no standard for determining what a suspect has to do in order to satisfy the requirement to provide a credible and reliable identification. Now, let me pause right here. In the Heibel case, Nevada's legislature came up with a simple solution. You don't have to have a driver's license. You could be an Amish man. You don't have to have a social security number. You don't have to have state ID. You don't have to have a passport. You just have to tell us, what is your name? And as we've already seen, that could be the beginning point of a criminal investigation that could be used against you if the officer is going to plug that name into NCIC. Now, there's three things that the policeman has to have. To identify you absolutely, he needs three things. He needs your name, George Gordon. He needs your social security number, and he needs your birth date. Now, there's lots of George Gordons out there. But it's highly unlikely that you're going to find any other George Gordon who has the same birth date that I have. Now, I don't practice birthdays. I don't practice birthdays on religious grounds because birthdays and the celebration of birthdays is witchcraft. The annual high day of a witch or warlock is his birthday. It's the highest holy day of a witch or warlock. I don't want to practice witchcraft. I don't want to get in the way of the millions of Americans who do practice birthdays and who want to practice birthdays. I just don't want that enforced upon me. The second is Social Security. Social Security is totally voluntary, and I chose not to volunteer. I don't want a Social Security number. 14 million Americans don't have Social Security numbers. And there's lots of George Gordons out there, and I would hate like heck to be accidentally identified as the wrong George Gordon without a Social Security number and a birth date in a stop by a policeman. who says, "What's your name?" And I say, "George Gordon." I plugged it into NCIC and I find six Gordons in here who have warrants for their arrest. So, Gordon, I'm going to arrest you because you must be one of those six George Gordons that has an arrest warrant. Shucks, boys and girls, they might make a misidentification. I think I'd just rather remain silent. Don't you? All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. You know, over the past century, we Americans who were once independent, capable, and able to manage our own financial, medical, and legal affairs, we've now been reduced to dependence, incompetence, incapacity. We've now been made wards of powerful commercial, financial, medical, and legal corporations, cartels, and bureaucratic institutions of our modern government and industrial society. And you and I have been taught to rely upon these paid professionals like bankers to manage our financial affairs, or doctors to manage and treat our health problems, and lawyers to direct our business and our legal affairs, instead of relying upon our own good common sense, our Bill of Rights, and our Constitution. Now that's why I contend that it's time that we Americans who were once able to catch our own fish learn once again how to fish instead of being fed by these paid professionals. You know, regaining our power of attorney is the single most important step in regaining our capacity, rights, liberties, and duties. Now, if you'd like to learn more about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you write to me and ask for my free general law CD package. It's educational, informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free of charge. You can order yours by simply calling direct 417-273-4967. Or if you're online, you can go to the website. It's georgegordon.org. Click on to the email. Send me an email request for your free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. You need to do it right now before you forget. You haven't done it yet, and we've been on the air 5 days telling you the same story. Do it now before you forget. georgegordon.org. Or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, Section 647E, the Supreme Court determined, is presently drafted and construed by the state courts, contains no standard for determining what a suspect has to do in order to satisfy the requirement to provide a credible and reliable identification. Because of that, the court says this statute, 647E, is unconstitutionally vague and ambiguous. They declare it to be unconstitutional. All right. Notice that in the Brown v. Texas case, the court did not say that the Texas statute was vague and ambiguous or unconstitutional. They said it was unconstitutional as it applied to Brown in that case. Had the two officers complied with the Terry rule, complied with reasonable suspicion, probable cause, or a combination thereof, they would have had a proper stop. But they didn't have any articulable, reasonable suspicion. The policeman couldn't say, "Well, we saw these two guys exchanging money in an alley, and it made us suspicious that this was a drug deal coming down, and so we stopped to investigate." Had they done that, Brown v. Texas would have been a much different case before us. That's another buzzword. Had this guy done thus and such, we'd have a much different case before us. They could have said that in Heibel. Had Heibel articulated his Fifth Amendment right, his Fifth Amendment concern about being arrested because he gave his name, had he told the policeman that, had he asked the policeman for probable cause, or asked the policeman for immunity from prosecution for this testimonial evidence that he was about to give, we'd have a much different case before us. You'll see those kinds of buzzwords every now and again. Well, as such, the statute vests virtually complete discretion in the hands of the police to determine whether the suspect has satisfied the statute and must be permitted to go on his way in the absence of probable cause to arrest. So an individual whom police may think is suspicious but do not have probable cause to believe has committed any crime is entitled to continue to walk the public streets only at the whim of any police officer who happens to stop that individual under 647E. Our concern here is based upon the potential for arbitrarily suppressing First Amendment liberties. In addition, 647E implicates consideration of the constitutional right to freedom of movement. See Kent versus Dulles. In addition, Section 647E is simply not a stop and identify statute. Rather, the statute requires that the individual provide a credible and reliable identification that carries a reasonable assurance of its authenticity and that provides means for later getting in touch with the person who has identified himself. In other words, California came up with a personal identification statute, which is patently unconstitutional. You know, our liberal politicians have been pushing for this national identification. And I mean Republicans and Democrats. I don't care who occupies the White House. This New World Order crowd wants national identification. And the thing that stands in their way is the Fourth and Fifth Amendments. So perhaps Heibel in disguise has actually come along to do us a great favor for those of us that don't carry identification. I thought I'd share it with you. You know, I walk down the streets every day. I don't have any identification in my pocket. None. Zero. Zilch. Zip. Now, when I travel, I carry personal identification that I created and filed with my county recorder so that in the event that I want to travel to California and I don't want to argue a case out in California or New Mexico and I want to identify myself, here's my identification. If I want to cash a money order, if I want to buy a money order, or I want to do something somewhere, I need to have some identification to do that, oftentimes. So I have identification. It's just that what I do is I get rid of the identification when we have a confrontation coming down. I mean, after all, sometimes there's money to be made off of these kinds of civil rights violations. And we have to get paid from time to time for these civil rights violations in order to pay us to stay in the game. After all, the government prosecutes us with our own money. We pay the taxes for our prosecution. Then we have to come into court and defend against our own money being used against us. And we have to pay for that also. So in reality, when you come into court, you know, these fair tribunals, you know, that were called fair trials, you have to pay for your own prosecution and pay for your own defense. And the government has unlimited resources to prosecute you with. You have limited resources to defend yourself with. So from time to time, we need to get paid under the Civil Rights Act so that we have enough money in the kitty to go out and make these meaningful political and social changes at the local level through the courts, just like we see going on here with Lawson or with Rosa Parks or with Brown v. Texas. At oral argument, the applicants confirmed, or the appellants rather, confirmed that a suspect violates 647E unless the officer is satisfied that the identification is reliable. In giving examples of how suspects would satisfy the requirement, the appellants explained that a jogger who was not carrying identification could, depending on the particular officer, be required to answer a series of questions concerning the route that he had followed to arrive at the place where the officers detained him, or could satisfy the identification requirement simply by reciting his name and address. I got to pause here and tell you a little story. There was a federal judge, an INS judge, a black federal INS judge down in Houston, Texas. He's down there jogging around one morning, and a couple of Houston's finest grabbed him. Just happened to be a couple of white cops, and this is a black man jogging. What they didn't know was that this black man was a federal judge, and they gave him this same kind of grief. They paid him handsomely. And you know, I think every one of you, whether you're white, black, Hispanic, green, yellow, or red, should be paid handsomely in exactly the same way that that federal judge is paid, in the same way that Lawson was paid for these kinds of indignities being visited upon you by the police. The police need to obey the laws just like everybody else. And the way we do that is through the Civil Rights Act of 1868, codified in 1871, and used so consistently and so effectively during the 1960s and 70s. It works for whites, just like it works for blacks, works for women, and it works for Hispanics. Boys and girls, right's right, and wrong is wrong. It's not gray. It's right or it's wrong, one or the other. Now, the appellants stress the need for strengthened law enforcement tools to combat the epidemic of crime that plagues our nation. So what we need is a fascist police state. That's what the police and the politicians are telling us. That's not what the courts are telling us. Now, I hear people constantly degrading and deriding the judges, and they just jump up and down and paw the ground and bite the bushes, and they are reciting the drivel that they have heard in the newspapers and over the news media. It's the news media that parrots the New World Order. It's the news media that is constantly criticizing the judiciary. It's the news media that constantly misreports, misconstrues, and misinterprets what the courts say. And listen, they don't do it once in a while, they do it every single time. I can never remember a case being reported in the press accurately and correctly. That's why I thought, let me take a couple of 3 days, it took 5 nights here, 5 hours, to explain the court's rational decision-making process. And I told you plainly, I don't agree with the conclusion. But this conclusion has not handicapped George Gordon. I've said it before, and I'm going to say it again. I'm not complaining about the courts. I'm not complaining about the IRS, the EPA, the State Tax Commission, or anybody else. Just let me stake out my 9 square feet on any courtroom floor in America. Let me come in and defend my rights to property, to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. I don't care what laws the government enacts. And if the Supreme Court comes along and says, all right, now, Gordon, from now on, you're going to have to articulate what your fears are in giving your name to the cop. Okay, Judge, let me articulate my fear. I've got 12 questions I want to ask the policeman. And if you want those 12 questions, just drop a $5 bill into an envelope, send it to me. Let me tell you, through free speech, here's what I think. Here's what I'm going to do. I'm not disappointed with Brown v. Texas, Lawson versus Colander, or Heibel versus Nevada. I can comply with all three of them. And I can do it walking, talking, and chewing gum and do it all at the same time. I would have preferred, though, that the court sided with the minority and came out 9-0 and said, a man can stand there and tell the cop to kiss off. We don't have to tell him jack squat, either in a Terry search or in a Miranda arrest. But, for whatever reason, the majority of the court decided to distinguish Heibel, and they did. But I want you to notice that here in the Lawson case, the court has come down against arbitrary and capricious enforcement of laws, and they came down on it hard and heavy. They did the same thing in Brown versus Texas. And don't think for a minute now that the courts now have abandoned Lawson or Brown in favor of Heibel. They haven't. As I've said several times now, it's up to you. The burden, the monkey is on your back now at the scene. You got to know what to ask and what to say. And I think I know what to ask, and I think I know what to say. And after all, that's the purpose now of the law school. The purpose here of the Gordon Law School, just like the Lawson Law School, is to instruct lay people, not lawyers. You lawyers, you know what to say. You know what to do. And if you don't, you're the proximate cause of your own injury. But what about carpenters, plumbers, electricians, housewives, and businessmen? We need to know how to assert our rights and how to use them effectively. All right. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. You know, in real estate transactions, we follow three rules. It's called location, location, and location. Well, you know, in criminal law, we follow three rules also when we talk to the police or government agents. And that is, don't say anything, keep your mouth shut, and shut up. You know, knowing what to say and when to say it, or knowing what not to say and who not to say it to, is summed up in this maxim of law, and that is, all of the evidence that's ever going to be used against you is going to be furnished by you. So keep your mouth shut, don't say anything, and shut up. And you know, that's why judges in their opinions, just like we're seeing here, judges make short, terse statements like these. Listen to this first judge. He said, quote, "Who would believe the ironic truth that the cooperative taxpayer fares much worse than the individual who relies upon his constitutional rights?" That comes from U.S. versus Dickerson. Assert your constitutional rights and shut up when you're in a tax case. Now, if I said something like that, you know, people would say, well, that guy Gordon, he's a tax protester. Listen to the second judge. I don't think the first judge is a tax protester. Here comes the second judge. He says, quote, "You can and must keep your mouth shut for protection under the Fifth Amendment in Belknap versus United States." If I said something like that, I'd be accused of obstructing justice. But that wasn't me that said that. That was a judge that said that. Third judge said, "The constitutional privilege was intended to shield the guilty and the imprudent." Got that? It's designed to shield the guilty and the imprudent as well as the innocent and farsighted. Comes from Marchetti versus United States. You know, you want to be the innocent and the farsighted, not the guilty and the imprudent. But it's there for both. Now, for more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you call me? The number to call, 417-273-4967. Hey, be sure to ask for my free general law CD package when you call. Remember, that's a four-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. Now, courtroom strategy and procedure is available on compact disc for adult home education. If you're online, go to the website. It's georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Click on the email machine. Send me an email request for your free general law CD package. Do it right now before you forget. That's georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. All right, we're reviewing the Lawson versus Colander case. The majority, 7-2, came down. Now, Justice Brennan also had something to say. He said, "I'm going to give you a concurring opinion." Now, oftentimes a judge will have a dissenting opinion, or he may have a concurring opinion. So Brennan is in the majority. He votes with the majority. I think we've come to the right conclusion. But he didn't like the opinion written by Sandra Day O'Connor. So he writes a separate opinion, saying essentially the same thing, but he puts in some of the factors that he thinks should have been in the opinion. And he says, "I join the court's opinion. It demonstrates convincingly that the California statute at issue in this case, 647E, as interpreted by the California courts, is unconstitutionally vague. Even if the defect identified by the court were cured, however, I would hold that this statute violates the Fourth Amendment." Ah, you see what he's saying here? Here's a judge that comes along and says, "Listen, even if this statute could meet Fifth Amendment standards, I would conclude that it violates the Fourth Amendment." Now, merely to facilitate the general law enforcement objectives of investigating and preventing unspecified crimes, states may not authorize the arrest and criminal prosecution of an individual for failing to produce identification or further information on demand by a police officer. And it's long been settled that the Fourth Amendment prohibits the seizure and detention or search of an individual's person unless there's probable cause to believe that he has committed a crime. except under certain conditions strictly defined by the legitimate requirements of law enforcement and by the limited extent of the resulting intrusion on individual liberty and privacy. And he refers us, he says, go see Davis versus Mississippi. Pretty powerful statements, you know. A whole lot more powerful statement coming out of that judge's mouth than we saw from the Boston Globe now, wasn't it? Remember a couple of nights ago I read you the opinion of the Boston Globe in their report on this very topic, personal identification. I'm telling you, boys and girls, the judges are on our sides. If you pay attention to what the judges say and listen to what the judges have to instruct you with instead of the Boston Globe and the New York Times and Dan Rather and Tom Brookjaw. That's why I've told my students for years, let's listen more to the judges and less to the politicians, the lawyers, and the media pundits. The judges have a whole lot more intelligent stuff to tell us than do the media journalists, New World Order crowd, or the social democrat communist politicians. He goes on to say that the scope of that exception to the probable cause requirement for seizures of the person has been defined by a series of cases, beginning with Terry versus Ohio, holding that a police officer with reasonable suspicion of criminal activity based on articulable facts may detain a suspect briefly for purposes of limited questioning, and in so doing may conduct a brief frisk of the suspect to protect himself from concealed weapons. Where probable cause is lacking, we have expressly declined to allow significantly more intrusive detentions or searches on the Terry rationale, despite the assertion of compelling law enforcement interests. For all but those narrowly defined intrusions, the requisite balancing has been performed in centuries of precedent and is embodied in the principle that seizures are reasonable only if supported by probable cause. Now, at the time that Terry came down, remember during the 1960s, there was a lot of raucous lawlessness and anarchy going on the streets. Remember the 1968 Democratic Convention? So the court said, yeah, you know, you got all these people running around on the street, and they're all acting like a bunch of horses patooties, and so I guess maybe the police do need some measure of protection against people carrying concealed weapons. So they authorized the limited, and I want to emphasize the word limited, stop and frisk Terry search. But you don't have to answer any questions. And in this case of Heibold, the only question that's at issue is your name. And I contend that you don't even have to give your name if you can articulate your fears of giving your name, and it could be the beginning point of a criminal investigation, or that it's vague and ambiguous, or, here are the Fourth and Fifth Amendment reasons. Now remember, you've got to articulate those to the policeman. That's why you need a series of questions to ask the policeman at the scene to demonstrate your concern. Heibold didn't do that. He just said, kiss off, I ain't talking. Used to be we could say that. No more. Heibel now has done us a great service. Thank you, Mr. Heibel. I appreciate your sacrifice and your hard work. Now let's learn a lesson. We do what the winners do and we avoid what the losers do. Now Heibel is a loser, so we want to avoid what Heibel did. Brown and Lawson are winners, so we want to do what Brown and Lawson did. And in the Heibel case, the court told us what the new standards are. So let's incorporate those new standards into our lifestyle so that in the future, we don't have these kinds of problems bedeviling us. Now, finally, he goes on to say, Terry and the cases following it gave full recognition to law enforcement officers' need for an intermediate response. short of arrest, to suspicious circumstances. The power to effect a brief detention for the purpose of questioning is a powerful tool for the investigation and prevention of crimes. Any person may, of course, direct a question to another person in passing. The Terry Doctrine permits police officers to do far more. If they have the requisite reasonable suspicion, they may use a number of devices with substantial coercive impact on the person to whom they direct their attention, including any official show of authority, the use of physical force to restrain him, and a search of the person for weapons. During such an encounter, very few people will ever feel free not to cooperate fully with the police by answering their questions. I want to pause right here. If you want to develop into a full-fledged civil rights investigator, I don't care whether the police knock you down, kick you in the ribs three times, and handcuff you, and make you stand up and torture you. You don't have any need or any duty to confess, to give information, to talk with, or to cooperate with the police in any way, shape, form, or manner. Now, read these cases for yourself. That's my conclusion, and that's what this judge is telling us right here. It is true, 99.9% of the people of America will spill their guts. They've been taught to do that from the time they were in the first grade. Americans do not cherish, protect, and practice their Bill of Rights. They've already been cunningly coerced into waiving their rights due to their ignorance. And the courts have said, hey, listen, if after you've been told that you've got a right to remain silent, you want to open your mouth and spill your guts, you just get right after it. No law against that. But nobody can compel you to testify against yourself, and nobody can compel you to cooperate with the police in your own conviction. So you don't have to talk to the police. And in the Heibel case, the only talk that's required by anybody, majority or minority, is your name and your name only. What we're looking for here is there an out to not even giving the policeman your name? And the courts have said, you bet. You bet. If you can articulate and show that you have a fear of being prosecuted in some separate prosecution, don't even give them your name. All right, I'm not complaining about the police. I'm not complaining about the government. A lot of it's wicked and evil, and there's a lot of wickedness and evil out there that needs to be corrected. The Gordon Law School is here for the purpose of training you in making those meaningful political and social changes in your local community. If you want to learn how, that's what we're here for. Well, we're about out of time. I think that'll just about cover this subject matter of Heibel, Brown, and Lawson. As I've said before, always go to the judge. Always go to the court. What you need in the Heibel case is go to Find Law, pull the case yourself, read it. And what the case says, what the judges say, is at variance with what we read in the Boston Globe and the New York Times. Get your law from the courts, not the press. You've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week on Truth Radio Network and worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Gordon Law School and the Law Hour, please go to my website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour website is updated weekly and has our radio log schedule of archives, and it can be accessed through my website, georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. Well, hey, there's the signal. It says our time is up. We'll see you back here, same time, same station, tomorrow night, God willing. So until then, good night, friends.